Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us today. This is Manju Chotani from AVAC, and I'm very happy to welcome you to this call highlighting the work of one of our 2014 fellows. Before I start, I will just want to acknowledge the passing of one of our fellows, one of our 2013 fellows, Oladayo Oyelakin Taiwo, as we knew him in Nigeria, who we lost last week. And on behalf of AVAC, send our condolences out to his family and community, and hope all of you will find a moment in your day sometime this week to go on the AVAC website and read a little bit about him. So with that, I'm very excited to welcome Definite Namo, who is one of our 2014 fellows. She is being hosted by the Pangaea Zimbabwe AIDS Trust, and she's in Harare. Definite, or Def as we like to call her, comes to us with quite an extensive experience. She worked for SHAZ, as you're going to hear about, which is Shaping the Health of Adolescents in Zimbabwe project. And her work was really centered around what adolescent sexual and reproductive health needs are, including contraception and the provision of ARVs. She's worked with a lot of different organizations in shaping and taking this project through its fruition, and now with her 2014 fellowship is looking to take some of the recommendations to the next level. So with that, I'd like to invite Definite. What we're going to do is she's going to go through her slides. I hope you all are on the web interface so you can follow along. She's going to present for us, and then we're going to have a chance to ask her questions. We've already got some questions via email. Keep them coming. But at the close of her presentation, we will also let people directly ask their questions. So without further ado, Definite.
Yes. Hi, Manju. Thank you so much, Manju. Hi, everyone. As Manju has just has already mentioned, my name is Definite Namo, and I'm a current AVAC fellow based here in Harare in Zimbabwe. Today I'll be talking to you about the work that I've been doing for the past 12 years prior to this AVAC fellowship and how this work is leading into my fellowship. So I'll be talking to you about the SHAZ project. And SHAZ really is an acronym for Shaping the Health of Adolescents in Zimbabwe. It is a combined intervention of life skills and economic livelihoods for female adolescents. Today I'll be presenting the key findings and recommendations from this study. Next slide, please. So in this presentation today, I'll start by giving you the background and context of the SHAZ project. I'll spend some time talking about the SHAZ model and intervention components. I'll go on to talk about key findings and recommendations, then discuss next steps. Next slide, please. So in terms of background, Zimbabwe has a population of about 13 million people, with 668,000 people on ART. Zimbabwe is ranked sixth highest in terms of HIV prevalence worldwide. The HIV epidemic is slowly stabilizing, but sadly, HIV incidence is on the increase among the 15 to 24-year age group. As we all know, adolescent women are twice as likely to be infected with HIV compared to their male counterparts. And structural factors, including poverty, gender inequalities, among others, fuel HIV treatment access. Next slide, please. So SHAZ really began with formative work in the year 2000. This formative work was designed to understand the social and economic factors among adolescents. In this work, we conducted focus group discussions, in-depth interviews, community consultations, and most importantly, since this was a community-based project, we had a lot of consultations with the community advisory board. Through this formative work, structural factors were identified, and these included social factors, gender norms, gender inequalities, exposure to violence, lack of income, and economic factors. All these structural factors most likely lead to high-risk behaviors or exposures, and will ultimately lead to negative biological outcomes. Examples will be HIV acquisition, STIs, and unintended pregnancy. So the SHARS model, which I'll talk to you about in a bit, really works in two ways. One is to mitigate effects of structural factors, as well as directly reduce high-risk behaviors or exposures. Next, please. So this really is in a nutshell, is really the SHARS model. Next slide, please. Now I'll talk to you in depth about the individual intervention components that were offered by SHARS. Now I'll start with the life skills education. The life skills curricula drew upon Stepping Stones and our CDC Zimbabwe Talk Time, and also drew upon the WILLOW modules. All this was really developed in input to the target population. We took a lot from the WILLOW modules, especially for the HIV positive cohort. So all this, the life skills was really developed, especially with consultations with the community advisory board as well. The life skills modules itself consists of 14 different modules that are delivered in groups of 20 over a 4 to 6 week period. And the modules are based on HIV, STI and reproductive health, relationship negotiation, strategies to avoid violence, and identification of safe and risky places and communities. Next slide, please. Here is an example of one of our community mapping exercises where participants were identifying the safe and risky places within their localities with the purpose of situating risk outside themselves. So the blue stars represent the safe places, whilst the red stars represent the risky places. For example, if you look closely at the map, you'll find that one of the secondary schools was noted as a risk place. This is really funny because all of us would think a secondary school would be a safe place, but this was because there was a non-perpetrator within that secondary school who would coerce girls to have sex in order to have like increased grades. So this exercise really helped the girls to identify which places to avoid. Next slide, please. Now I'll talk about the economic livelihoods component. So the economic livelihoods intervention consisted of financial literacy education and a choice of vocational training at local training institutes. These courses were 6 months long. They were conducted in English, and they had to have both a practical and a theoretical component. So in spite of our encouragement to the girls to venture outside of the acceptable gender norms, the most popular courses were hairdressing, garment making, receptionist, secretarial, and nurse aid training. So after doing this vocational training a few months down the line, we realized that not all participants were able to commit to the six-month training due to other responsibilities. We then introduced the three-day vocation, which included floor wax, liquid soap detergent, and cordial making. After vocational training, participants who were successful, who had completed their vocational training and passed, were required to develop a business plan that was supported by a micro grant in the form of capital equipment, supplies, or additional training. The materials purchased with these micro grants were valued at $100 per participant. Next slide, please. We also offered comprehensive health services. Participants were provided with health screening at every study visit, comprehensive sexual reproductive health services. Participants were screened and treated for treatable STIs and other minor ailments. We ensured that adolescents who needed contraception had access to it. Participants received condoms and any other form of contraception, and this was offered free of charge upon request. Participants who tested HIV positive were referred to local clinics where the study team assisted with ART registration, including CD4 count tests required for enrollment into the ART program. Participants did not have to wait in long queues as the whole ART initiation process was initiated by SHARS. We also linked participants who tested positive to pregnancy to PMTCT services. Next slide, please. Now I'll talk about the integrated social support services that we offered during the SHARS intervention. So integrated social support is what we call ISS, and this guided the economic livelihoods component. The integrated social support consisted of guidance counseling provided by a trained staff to help participants navigate challenges. Participants were required to choose a self-selected adult mentor to assist them throughout the program. We also organized participant reunions at six-month intervals, and the purpose really was to bring together participants in groups of 20 to reflect on what they learned in life skills, as well as share their life experiences. Next slide, please. With the SHARS model that I talked about earlier on, we conducted two trials. The first trial was the primary prevention trial, and the next one was the secondary prevention trial. I'll present on both trials today, and both trials were exactly the same in terms of design and intervention delivery. The only difference was that in the primary prevention trial, we enrolled HIV-negative participants, while in the secondary prevention trial, we enrolled HIV-positive participants. In both trials, we enrolled female adolescents who were aged between 16 and 19, who were out of school, not currently pregnant, and willing to be tested for HIV. Next slide, please. So this is really the basic design of the SHARS study. Intervention arm received all the intervention components that I described earlier on, whilst the control arm received life skills, HIV and SRX services throughout the study. Next slide, please. So now on the research side. This collage shows the research site where we were conducting the research. We conducted the research in Chitungwiza. This is on the map. I hope you can see where Chitungwiza is. So this is really an urban area, a high-density area, 30 kilometers outside of Harare. And the two other pictures actually show the actual hospital where we work from, and the hospital is called CityMed Hospital. Next slide, please. Now I'm going to talk to talk on key findings for both trials, starting with the primary prevention trial. Please note that I'm presenting findings that we found in between study arms. What we found out was that there were statistically significant improvements among the intervention arms in economic sectors such as food security and income levels. We also found improvements in HIV risk factors such as transactional sex, condom use, and experience of violence among the intervention arm participants. There were significant reductions in unintended pregnancy in effect size, although the actual finding was not statistically significant for the intervention arm. However, we did not see any differences in HIV incidence, even though the study was not powered for this. We did not see trends in the direction we expected. Next slide, please. Now on to the secondary prevention trial. Similarly, we observed statistically significant differences among intervention and control arms, with the intervention arm showing improvements in condom use and food security. We did not see any differences in CD4 counts or in incidence of opportunistic infections or other health-related outcomes, although for the secondary prevention trial, we were powered to detect differences, but we did not see any. Next slide, please. Now, this slide shows the self-reported wealth over the duration of the study by study participants. As you can see, the intervention arm experiences a steady increase that seems to level off after 12 months into the study, whilst the control arm also experiences a steady increase, which seems to taper off at 12 months into the study. The trend was higher in the intervention arm. We are not too sure why. Next slide, please. Overall, in both trials, there were not as much differences between the intervention arm and the control arm. However, there seems to be significant changes when you look at pre- and post-intervention. There were statistically significant changes from baseline to end point. We did see more flat findings in overall good health. Next slide, please. So in the two trials show improvements by study arm in economic and social factors, but this was not the case with biological outcomes. This was not expected. However, the good news is that the pre- and post-analysis of the data show significant improvements over time among the overall sample. Oh, is it because I don't know why we did not find significant differences between arms. Maybe it could be because of the sample size, the study duration. Maybe it was the study design itself. We are not sure. But these results really underscore the need to find new ways of evaluation designs that best enable us to access a true and appropriate control condition. In our study, the control arm did receive a strong intervention. For example, the life skills and access to health services, which could have been a major intervention on its own. We did feel strongly that ethically we should provide this component to the control arm. Next slide. So this still on that. So these findings also suggest that livelihoods do work. We did not get the impact that we'd have hoped for, but we now know that it is critical to engage adolescents in things like life skills. Ensure access to comprehensive SRH and HIV services for adolescents, offer them social spaces, offer them comprehensive support services, as well as offering them opportunities for peer support. At least this is what we know from the SHA study. So with this information, what's next? Next slide, please. The one that says the hub. So in an effort to address some of these findings, SHAS is in the process of establishing a drop-in center for adolescents where we hope to provide comprehensive SRH and HIV services. SHAS is actively looking and mobilizing resources to provide these services, as well as leverage resources within Chitungwiza to directly link services to the drop-in center so it becomes a one-stop shop for the adolescents. So these findings from SHAS were really the inspiration behind my fellowship today. As SHAS is trying to turn research into reality, so as to quote Michelle, the research can only go so far. My fellowship is focusing on how we can be able to influence policy at national level so as to increase access to SRH and HIV services for adolescents, with really a special interest in also expanding the contraceptive method mix for young women in Zimbabwe. If we are able to increase access to SRH services for adolescents and get them to seek and access youth-friendly services, we'll have made strides in decreasing the HIV incidence among adolescents that is currently on the increase in Zimbabwe, as well as also have an impact on the high rates of unintended pregnancies. I'm personally really interested in seeing how increasing a contraceptive method mix would benefit adolescent women and how this could potentially reduce unintended pregnancies. Next slide, please. The acknowledgement. I would like to acknowledge the SHAS participants themselves, the community advisory boards that we work closely with in this study, the SHA staff members, the SHA's principal investigators, ZAP UZ, where we conducted the trials from, Pangea Global Aid Foundation as the administrator of funds, NIH as the funder, and AVAC for according me the opportunity to present these findings today. I will now leave this time for comments, clarifications, and questions. Thank you. Back to you, Manju. Hello?
Thank you so much, Definite. That was a really interesting presentation that helped us understand what you found and kind of the way forward. And the importance of Definite's fellowship is, as we in bringing it back to prevention research and looking for, you know, turning research into reality, is right now if young women and adolescents can't access services, how are we really going to create the environment for them to access future services and future interventions that so much investment has been made into? And we're really excited about this policy work she's going to do. But enough for what we think. Really interested in any questions or comments to Definite. We have some that came in via email. Before reading those, if people wanted to ask themselves, to unmute yourself, you press *7. And please just state your name and your country, and please be kind with Definite.
Hello.
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 Hi, my name is...
Go ahead, Hello. We can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. My name is Shindai. Seattle. I'm calling from Zimbabwe. And I just want to congratulate Definite for a very job well done in the SHARP project. My question basically is the young women who you were both, who are in the negative and positive in the initial stages, have there been any contact with them to find out if their behavior or they're collecting themselves in terms of HIV and AIDS has changed, or yeah, now just, you know, a statistic in the world? Because I think it would be great to make a follow-up and see if after the intervention, has their behavior changed now when they are now 5-6 years outside the project? Thank you.
Okay, Manju, do I answer that now?
Please go ahead. I mean, why don't you go ahead and people can gather their thoughts for more questions.
Okay. Thank you so much, Tendai. Great question, indeed, because we know behavior is best measured over longer periods of time. But what we've done in the SHARP study is we've gone back to the prevention trial, as well as the secondary prevention trial for those who exited earlier on. And what we're really looking at was the economic component and how it has had an effect over time, because we saw that maybe just the study, we didn't have like enough time to measure the economic effects of the study. So we've not really asked questions on behavior change. Of course, we've asked, but we don't, we didn't measure it. We didn't actually test the participants for HIV. But we did ask, and this was really based on reported information. And this data hasn't been formally analyzed, but I can tell you what's coming up is most participants we've had qualitative interviews with were reporting that they have been tested and they are being tested periodically, and most of them have remained negative. But then it also has its flaws. Like I said, this is reported data. I don't know what are the chances that a person would really tell you, after SHARS, a year after SHARS, I was tested and I tested positive. Of course, some would say that, but most of the participants are really saying they have continued to get an HIV test periodically and they have remained negative for that cohort. Thank you.
Thanks, Beth. Any other questions on the phone? Maybe I'll ask one of the questions that came via email, Def, to you. So one question came in advance of the webinar that said, since the knowledge of STIs, prevention, care, and treatment are of vital importance to HIV, what is the current knowledge levels for female adolescents in Zimbabwe on STIs?
Okay. That's a tricky one. To the best of my knowledge, we just have the ZDHS that talks about HIV knowledge. So if we take HIV in the context of an STI, the knowledge levels are around 60%. But in our studies, in both trials, what we did was we also had ACASI, which is audio computer-assisted interviews, where we asked participants a number of knowledge questions at baseline, and they were asked at every study visit at 6 month intervals. And what we noticed was there was a steady increase in knowledge. There was an increase in knowledge from the time they came in at baseline, and when you compare that to end point. And this is also because in the SHARS study, we did offer life skills, which is really it has like knowledge-based it's knowledge-based information on STIs, on HIV, on how to live positively. So we do want to credit the increase in knowledge to the life skills. But at national level, like I said before, to the best of my knowledge, we just have the ZDHS. I'm not aware of national data that speaks to knowledge in STI awareness. Thank you.
I think we just briefly lost Manju here, but we can continue to take questions on the line. Again, it's *7 to unmute. And as a reminder, if you're feeling a little shy, you can also email questions to avac@avac.org, or if you're logged on to the web component, you can just enter them into the chat box. So *7 to unmute. Does anyone have a question on the line?
Hi, Def. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
It's Sindra from AVAC. I was wondering, can you talk a little bit about the economic support that they got? For example, is the money that they got, was it a livable wage, or was it just enough to buy a meal? So can you just give some details about that?
Okay. Thanks, Sindra. So in terms of the economic livelihood component, the economic livelihood component that we gave as an intervention in the SHAS project was really the vocational training that I talked about, the six-month vocational training, where they would go to institutions and actually receive vocational training for 6 months. That would also offer like transport money for them to go there every day. This is for the intervention. And when they also came prior to vocational training for life skills, for both the control and the intervention arm, they received transport money. So this transport money was really enough for them to go to their houses and come back. But what ended up happening was some participants would opt to work and use that money for different things, maybe to buy food at home, or to buy something for the baby, depending on their situation. And when they came in for the study visits, would also reimburse them transport money and reimburse them for their time spent at the study site. So those were really the economic components, but the actual economic component that was directly an intervention was the vocational training. But the other monies, I think this was just the participants being innovative with the money that they got.
Great. And are the women using those new skills beyond the trial to actually make more money?
Yeah.
Do you know?
Thanks, Sindra. This is actually data that is still being analyzed, like I said, for the qualitative follow-up visits that we conducted. But the emerging issues are that participants are actually using the skills that they got, and they're using the skills to generate more money. And this is even during the trial, we did see that happening even in the control arm, where some of them started small businesses using the transport monies that they received during the study.
Great, thank you.
Any questions on the line? Otherwise, there are a few more email questions I can put to you, definite.
Okay. I think maybe you can go.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, definite. Thank you for that great presentation. I have two quick questions. One is about the community risk mapping exercise that was done. I found that to be really creative. My question is, and this is Angelo from AVAC. My question about that, is there going to be any follow-up to try to help mitigate some of the the areas that were identified from this community mapping as risky to make them less risky or not risky? You know, are there recommendations and some action that might be done to help in that situation? Then the other question is about the aspect around the relationship negotiation skills. Again, are these things that I know, you know, this again needs time, but is this something that you are seeing as the participants taking forward in terms of using those skills going forward? And again, thank you for your great presentation and great work.
Okay, thanks, Angelo. On your first question on the community risk mapping, I think we understand as a research project, you can only go so far in terms of actual intervention in the community. But what we did after we heard all this information, we would feed back to the community advisory board. Because the community advisory board is really constituted of different representatives from the communities, and would also have like school teachers within that board. So we gave feedback back to the community advisory board to say this is what we're seeing in SHAS, this is what the adolescents are telling us. And then they were going to intervene in their own small ways. So, for example, for this secondary school, could would probe and ask what really is happening, why would the secondary school be a risky place? So we would feed back to the CAP. So in the CAP, then the teacher would go and find a way of intervening within that school. So as a research project, we were not intervening directly in the community, but we are working with the community advisory boards, which are really the bridge between research and the community. So they would then go ahead and do the action points that would be needed. And in terms of relationship negotiation skills, it is interesting you asked this question. Like, we all know the theory of change says, like, if you are equipped with skills and knowledge, ultimately it should lead to behavior change or it should lead to empowerment. But from the SHAS study, we did realize that there are limitations to giving one information and skills. There is the economic component that was missing, because you can't act on information unless if you're really empowered, and we're also talking economic empowerment. So we did see some adolescents who really acted on this relationship negotiation skills, because some of them were married early and they were like in abusive relationships. Some were able to emancipate themselves, although for some it was difficult to move out of a sort of abusive relationship, because they didn't have the economic empowerment to stay on their own and stand on their own 2 feet. So it's yes and no at the same time, depending on the situation, but overall, the girls were really equipped with this relationship negotiation skills. Some reported they went back home and they were able to negotiate for condom use. Although it was difficult, it wasn't always smooth flowing. They did face hurdles, and some of them would come back with their partners for couple counseling at the SHAS clinic. So it's a yes and no.
Thank you.
Definite. Thank you. You're taking all these questions on one after the other. There's a question here about how healthcare providers respond to young women seeking sexual and reproductive health services. And in your work, did you come across barriers to getting healthcare providers to provide adequate information and services to young women? And if that came up, how did you deal with it? And a second question is that the study involved 16 to 19-year-olds, but what about adolescents younger than that who need or are accessing services?
Thank you, Manji. On the first question, for the study, I think there was a deliberate effort to recruit younger staff members, younger professionals, because there was that realization that out there in the communities, adolescents cannot access comprehensive sexual reproductive health services and information, especially when it comes to contraception. Because not to stigmatize, but generally what happens is if there's an older person, whether male or female, who's providing, I'll take the example of contraception, and a young adolescent, like a 16-year-old, comes in looking for contraception, they'll probably see their daughter in that, and they'll start giving them the talk that, you know, you're not supposed to be engaging in sex, you're too young, can you concentrate on school? So we did have, like, a deliberate effort to recruit young staff members, and they were trained to be adolescent-friendly prior to the study starting. So we did not have these challenges. But I can understand this question at a national level where a service provider is not youth-friendly trained, then would have this, these challenges. So I think as part of the advocacy work, we should be advocating for service providers to be adolescent-friendly, to be youth-friendly, to look at adolescents as service providers other than looking at them as children, because this is why we have these problems of high rates of unintended pregnancies. Because if an adolescent goes to the clinic and they see that they're not, they can't access the services that they have, that they want, then that's a barrier, and next time when they want that service, they're unable to come back to the same clinic or health facility to access the services. So I think this is where we really need service providers to be trained in being youth-friendly. And on the second question of we were dealing with 16 to 19-year-old adolescents, what about the younger adolescents? In our formative phase, we did work with a 13-year-old, so it was it was grouped as 13 to 15 and 16 to 19. And the problems we encountered was were that Ministry of Education did not allow the 13 to 15-year-olds for the research members to have access to the 13 to 15-year-olds before they had offered assent. So what would happen is the adolescent would be given a consent form, and they would need to take it to their guardian or parent so that the guardian offers consent, and the younger adolescent can only offer assent. And this is really a national policy in Zimbabwe that anyone who's below the age of 16 cannot consent. Legally, they cannot consent. So this is why in the two trials I presented today, we worked with 16 to 19-year-olds, because at least 16-year-olds can give consent, but any younger adolescent younger than 16, they cannot offer consent. So I think there is a challenge right there where researchers or organizations cannot directly work with adolescents that are younger the age of 16. As long as the policy stands that says the legal age of majority is 16, I think anyone who's working within that framework would need to be abided by that 16 by the 16 years, and you cannot work with the under 16 unless if you go through the guardians and the parents, and we all know how difficult that can be. That alone can be a barrier in itself. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Definite. And unless there are any other questions, maybe I'll ask you one final question of my own, which is, with all this rich, you know, data you've collected and your team has collected through Shaz, and now you are thinking of, you know, your fellowship project is focused on developing policy specifically to create, you know, access to services for adolescents. What would be a few of the ideal things you think would belong in a policy as you're entering into this process?
Oh, thank you, Manju. I will try and answer that. Yeah, as I look at it, some of the policy elements that I think should be included are really like a deliberate effort, like a deliberate statement that says adolescents can actually access contraception as and when it is needed. I know the usual debate will be, are we not encouraging adolescents to have sex? But I think if we have an enabling policy environment that would say they can access contraception as and when it is needed, I think that would be great for me, at least, because as much as we'll not talk about it and we'll continue to ignore it, we continue to have this increase in unintended pregnancies, this increase in HIV incidence among the same population. So I think most importantly for me, just a clause or a policy framework that says adolescents can access contraception as and when it is needed. And also having, like, increasing the method needed for women in general, I think that would be great, because we all know the issues surrounding the oral pill. We have adherence issues with that, and when it comes to the condom, we all know the issues related to that, that you need to negotiate with your partner. And I will not go into the depth or conversation for now, but just looking at the oral pill and the condoms, which is what most adolescents use, we have adherence issues, we have issues where they have to negotiate with their partners. So I think also a policy framework that alludes to just in widening the contraceptive method mix for women in general, and I'm looking specifically at adolescents. Yeah, I think for now those would be like my major issues, and also just maybe demand creation for sexual reproductive health services and HIV services. We know adolescents have low health-seeking behaviors, so at least have enabling policies that will make them come to access those services. This is why I think having, like, drop-in centers dotted all over Zimbabwe, all over Harare, where adolescents can come in for, maybe they're coming in for indoor entertainment, they're coming in for just to get accurate information on SRH, and that's when they can actually say, okay, there are HTC services there, let me just go. I'd come here to meet up with my friends for peer support networks. But if services are available, let it be like a one-stop shop where they come in for information and all other services are there. They're right there. They don't need to go and look for them. I think such a policy framework would be great. For me, it would be the best thing that ever happened. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Definite. That was excellent. And thank you so much for spending the hour with us and giving this presentation. You did a fantastic job. And I'm sure everyone on this call will join me in clapping at their desks and giving you virtual applause. And unless there are any other burning questions, I would like to wish all of you a good day and thank Definite again. The slides will be available online. This is a recorded, this webinar has been recorded, so you'll be able to get a copy of that as well. If you have further questions for Definite, you can always contact her directly or through us. So best everyone, and thank you, Definite.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, everyone.